On February 9th of 2004, 21-year-old UMass student Maura Murray drove from her dorm in Amherst, Massachusetts to the White Mountains of New Hampshire.
At approximately 7:27 p.m., Maura spun out her 1996 Saturn on a hairpin turn on Route 112 in North Haverhill. There has never been a credible sighting of Maura since.
Maura is 5'7" tall. She weighs 120 pounds, and she has brown hair and hazel eyes.
If you have any information regarding Maura's disappearance, please submit it to us, the Murray family, through their Facebook page, or the New Hampshire State Police Cold Case Unit.
This is Missing Maura Murray. Welcome back to Missing Maura Murray. I'm Tim, here today with Lance in the Crawl Space Studios in Wormtown. Lance, how are you today?
Oh, I'm doing very well. How are you today, Tim?
I'm doing all right. And we have a bit of a blast from the past in this episode, Lance, don't we?
Yeah. James Renner puts the blast in the past, as they say. I don't know what that means, but it was a good conversation that we had with him, and it was a bit overdue to catch back up with him. And I mean, the primary reason why we wanted to talk to him was to attempt to shed some light on the allegations that have been brought against Maura's ex-boyfriend, Bill Rausch. So that's part of the conversation that we have with him in this interview.
Okay, so I hope you enjoy it and get something out of it. Check out James Renner's blog. There is a link in the show notes and also to his book. So thank you very much for listening. Welcome back to the Missing Maura Murray podcast. James Renner, how are you today, James?
I'm great. Is this I was wondering, is this the first time I've been back since you wrangled me?
Oh boy.
Not including CrimeCon?
Oh well, yeah, I guess there was CrimeCon.
Yeah. But I think officially as far as an episode goes, I since you wrangled me. Oh, stop it. It was just a cool title.
Wrangling Renner.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad personally to hear that you're doing well, that you said you're doing well, because it's been a trying year for you. I was gonna say a trying couple of months, but it's been a hard year for you. Is that accurate?
Well, you know, not really. I mean, in the very limited space of what is the Maura Murray mystery. It's been a little wonky. But outside of that, it's a very small part of my life anymore. Outside of that, I've had another book that came out, and I've started a nonprofit raising money for new DNA testing for cold cases. I've been on this comedy tour. So I've been having a great time, you know, outside of everything that is the Maura Murray case.
All right, cool.
So tell us about the comedy tour.
Yeah.
You know, I took a look at the comedy scene and I realized what they were missing was murder.
Really?
And, what inspired me was, do you guys remember this? Do you guys remember Spalding Gray at all?
Spalding Gray sounds so familiar. Was he an actor?
It sounds familiar.
He was this like monologuist in the 80s, and he got famous for a little while for this Swimming to Cambodia and Monster in a Box. And he would sit behind a desk on stage and he would tell these fascinating stories about his life that were sometimes humorous. And nobody's really kind of done that since then. And I got thinking about him for a couple reasons in the last year. I had a chance to do a workshop with him about 15 years ago. He came into Cleveland, and I got to meet this guy who was like a hero of mine. And it was probably about 6 months maybe it was shortly thereafter where he committed suicide back in New York. He stepped off the Staten Island ferry.
Oh, wow.
You know, so I found myself in New York last year doing some reconnaissance on Governor's Island, and you see the Staten Island ferry, and I'm like, oh, you know, it just kind of put his name in my mind again, and I realized nobody's really doing the Spalding Gray stuff. So I thought what might work is essentially what would be a monologue that is, you know, has some jokes, has some humor, has some funny, but it's also stories about working as a true crime journalist in Cleveland for about 10 years. And all the scary situations I got myself into and bizarre people I met. And so that became this tour that I put together called the Confessions of a True Crime Addict. And so I toured, I made it a part of the CrimeCon thing this year. So I drove down to Nashville and did Zanies in Nashville and then Birmingham and into New Orleans and up the East Coast. And then I just got back from a tour of the West Coast.
How did that go?
It went great. Yeah, it's going really well. I think I'm having a lot of luck with these comedy clubs because what I'm doing for them is bringing them new people, you know, people that wouldn't normally be going to a comedy club on a weeknight. And, you know, of course that gets them, you know, hopefully more repeat customers. And so it's a niche that nobody else is really filling, at least not in the comedy clubs.
Well, that's cool. Yeah. I was going to ask if, the most of the audience is people who follow you regularly, or if there are people who, are local to the area and just wanted to see an interesting show.
It's mostly the latter. It's mostly people that are just interested in true crime in general. Most of these people have not heard of me. I would say a good chunk of the audience they're murderinos. You know, they follow My Favorite Murder, that podcast. And what that podcast is really good at doing is creating these little communities that find each other and go to their shows. And so when they hear about this, they bring their group down. And so it's worked out well.
Do you get any requests for certain stories that people know about, whether they've read your book on Amy Mihaljevic or whether they read True Crime Addict? Do you take requests from the audience?
No, I don't. I have a pretty tight set, as they say. It's about an hour and 15, hour and 20 minutes.
Oh, wow.
And, it has its own structure. And I don't do Q&As or anything like that. I just get up, I perform, I tell these stories. I wait 5 minutes, you know, for the standing ovation to die down at the end. And,
yep.
And then, then I'm done. You know, one thing that became apparent on this tour, and I'm very glad I did it, it kind of gets you out of your echo chamber and out of your box. And, you know, we can stay at home and in these little true crime communities. You know, with us, it's the Maura Murray case, right? And we're so immersed in this case that we think everybody knows all the details and everybody's familiar with Maura's case. And I'll tell you, you know, even after all the publicity that you guys have provided and the book has provided and the documentaries provided, nine out of 10 people out there don't know who the hell Maura Murray is. So it's kind of eye opening. It just kind of shows you that, you can get caught in an echo chamber sometimes.
Oh, sure. You mean when we just release episode after episode on this podcast with their name and you have the blog, you do get caught up in this echo chamber. I can imagine how, refreshing it is to open yourself up to a new audience and
yeah.
Reintroduce yourself or newly introduce yourself to,
right.
to a new group of people.
Right, right. It's that's what I enjoy about it.
Now, do you tell any more stories?
I do a little bit, not much. I just kind of give an overview of the case and how I got involved in it. I tell the the story about the Dirtbag 112 video on the 8th anniversary and how all that shook down. Nice. That's about it. I talked more about Amy Mihaljevic and you know, how I got involved in true crime and, you know, some of the weird situations I've got into. Like, there's this one story I tell where, you know, everybody has this image in their mind of a, you know, when they think of reporter, they think of these seedy journalists who dig through people's garbage. And, you know, I'm like, that never really happens. That's, you know, that's kind of ridiculous, except for once. And, and then I tell the story about how I dug through this guy's garbage. And, he was a suspect in the Amy Mihaljevic case and a really good suspect. And, I went to his house and tried to question him and knocked on the door, and he opens it up, and there are these three cats that come out around his feet. And, they're like these giant cats, like Maine Coon long haired cats. I'm trying to question him, but I'm fiercely allergic to cats. As soon as I see him, my eyes start to water. And, you know, so I'm like, where were you the night that Amy Mihaljevic disappeared? And then I'm sneezing and I'm trying to interrogate this guy while I'm having an allergy attack. And finally he just gets frustrated and says, all right, sport. He's like, get out, you know, get off my property. And so I leave and I realize, oh my God, I've tipped this guy off. Now he's got to get rid of the evidence. And mind you, I'm 24 years old at the time, young, dumb, and stupid. And but I'm thinking, I tip this guy off. He's going to get rid of the evidence, and he'll probably throw it away. And so, what I do when I get home, I call up the waste management company, and I'm like, hey, I just moved to, and I name the guy's street. When do I put out my garbage on the lawn? And they say, oh, it's Thursday night, and we'll come to pick it up Friday morning. So put it out Thursday night. So Thursday night rolls around, 2 o'clock in the morning. I go to Target that day, and I buy like $20 worth of like black clothing, because that's what you're supposed to wear. And I drive up 2 o'clock in the morning to this guy's house, and I park like, just to be safe, I park like a half mile away. And jog there. And by the time I'm there, I'm like out of breath. But it worked. Like, all the garbage was on the lawn, the front lawn. And so I pick up the first bag, and it's heavy, like criminally heavy. Like, there must be a torso inside this bag. And so I'm like, I got this bastard. And so I run back to the car and toss it in the back seat, drive to a 24-hour convenience store, run around to the back, grab the bag and rip it open like a bag of peanuts. And cat litter and cat turds went everywhere.
Well, there you go. And you're allergic.
I'm fiercely allergic. And it smells like death. It's disgusting. And I realize not all the turds are solid, and it's droopy, and like just the worst. And so then I have to go to a 24-hour like car wash, and I'm that creep at 3 o'clock in the morning, fiercely vacuuming out his back seat like he just killed somebody.
Yeah. The tables have turned.
Right. Sometimes journalists go digging through garbage, but usually it's only like once. And then,
now,
then
is this legal?
Oh, it's totally legal in Ohio anyways. Like, as soon as you put your stuff on we call it the tree lawn here, also known as the devil strip. And, as soon as it's out there, it's free reign.
Okay. And that's the only time you've dug through someone's garbage.
Well, now that I think about it, I guess that's not entirely true, but I've talked about that in the True Crime Addict book.
Yeah, okay.
You got me. Maybe one other time.
I'm like the Renner whisperer.
Yeah.
So there's been some news that you teased and then put out there on your blog recently. Do you want to get into that?
Sure, I can talk about it a little bit. So as some people might know, I reported about a year, it's been maybe like a year and a half, that Bill Rausch, who was Maura Murray's boyfriend at the time of her disappearance, was under investigation for sex assault in Washington, D.C. And then I reported that there was an indictment imminent, and then the indictment was served. I think April of this past year, finally. And this is regarding an incident that happened in 2011 while he was the director or he worked for Ray Group International, which I believe was a nonprofit that helped veterans. And, you know, the full story is on my blog, but suffice it to say, this woman is alleging that he attempted to rape her in the office of the president of Ray Group International. And the attack was interrupted by a coworker who happened to come back to the office, luckily. And when they heard her come through the door, Bill jumped off her and hid underneath a desk and told her, don't say a word of this. This never happened. And then the woman's friend helps her get out. Now, this wasn't the first time he attacked this woman. It was the first time he attacked her sexually. But in the weeks leading up to this attack, in March of 2011, she was going up the escalators in the metro. And if you have ever been in the metro system in DC, these escalators are like two stories tall. They're very scary, you know, escalators. And she was riding the escalator and somebody pushed her down hard enough where she hurt herself pretty bad and it ripped her clothing. She had to go home and change. But when she was knocked down, she looked up and she saw Bill. And so she went home and got changed and came back and confronted him in the office and said, "What the hell? Why did you push me down the stairs on the metro?" And he kind of laughed it off and said, "Oh, that wasn't me. You must have seen somebody else." But when he was attacking her in March of that year, according to this woman, one of the first things he said was, "Okay, yes, that was me on the metro." So some rough stuff. And the only reason he wasn't prosecuted for that crime, by the way, is because the statute of limitations had run out by the time that this last spring rolled around.
What was the allegation? Was it the allegation of abuse in the office, or was it allegations of what he did or what he allegedly did on the metro?
I'm not sure I understand your question. So she reported all this to police, and they ended up charging him for the sexual assault in the office.
Oh, I see. Gotcha. I guess my question was he charged for, or is there a charge for pushing her down the stairs in the metro?
No, that would be just a simple assault, apparently. Although, in my mind, that's if you're pushing somebody down the metro, in my mind, that's an attempted murder. But anyways, it would have been assault, and it was beyond the statute of limitations. So we're unable to charge him. And once her story became public, five other women have contacted me alleging offenses from sexual harassment, from simple sexual harassment, all the way to this woman claims he choked her when he was at Fort Sill. This was 6 months after Mora's disappearance, and choked her and said, "I'm going to kill you like I killed Mora." That woman was a wife of another soldier at Fort Sill who was sent away. So anyways, the new stuff that's come out is I had to go to DC about 2 weeks ago, and while I was there, these new allegations came forward. A new woman went to the police, and this is a woman who I've known about for a couple years. I knew that she was seeing Bill. Bill has separated from his wife. I don't know, where they are with a divorce or anything like that. But this woman was seeing him, and she was no fan of mine, and it had said as much. And then she kind of went quiet, and I didn't hear from her for a while. And then she comes out with these allegations. So I find these allegations to be extremely credible, because this woman knows Bill Rausch better than anybody else, I think. I think better than his wife knew him. And so just real quick, what she's alleging is that, their relationship started with essentially what would have been a sexual assault, or at least very aggressive move by Bill. He invited her into his office and threw her up against the door and proceeded to kiss her, and then walked her back to her desk and made sure that all of her G-chat messages between him and her were deleted. And then he would hit her, you know. This is what she's alleging, that he hit her so hard once that he chipped a tooth. She says on two occasions he choked her and called her Mora, and would say very demeaning things. He would call her Mora and say, "You're a bitch," and even more demeaning things after that. That really alarmed her. There was an incident that happened on Valentine's Day where Bill tossed her into the air inside her apartment, and she ended up hitting her head on a light, which caused a large gash. Blood was everywhere. He insisted on riding to the hospital with her in the ambulance and staying by her side when doctors questioned her, and told the nurse to make him her emergency contact. And it's my belief that he wouldn't leave her side during that hospital visit because he was afraid of a domestic violence allegation. At least one of these assaults took place while Bill was at an overseas military base, which means that this could result in charges through military court channels, which would be kind of a big deal. Another thing that came out was all this stuff where Bill was using fake social media accounts to harass me and also to kind of steer the narrative of the online investigation into Maura Murray's disappearance. So some serious allegations. They might lead to more charges. He's been served with a restraining order. He's to go nowhere near this woman.
That's based on the new allegations?
Yeah, the new allegations. And if he goes nearer, he'll be arrested.
Wow. Was this documented in court, or is this,
yes.
I know this is stuff that you posted about, but okay. So, you got legal documents about this stuff too?
Yes. I have the police report, I've been able to verify that the restraining order was served, late last week. So Bill has it. And, there's court record of that, restraining order and their attempts to, I don't know what's going to happen next with the civil case, but, at the very least he's facing some kind of, case there as well.
When were you first connected to the alleged victim?
I don't want to get too much into that.
Okay.
I've been asked not to go into the details about, any sort of, communication if some communication does exist with the victim. This was news to me as of about 2 weeks ago. I knew of the woman and I suspected abuse because I had heard about the Valentine's Day incident, from other people. Mm-hmm. But I didn't know the extent, of the abuse until about 2 weeks ago.
Now, do you have any, indication that, say, the medical records have been filed with the proper authorities at this point? You said that she chipped a tooth. I don't know. Did she get that fixed at, at a dentist, or the gash in her head?
I think she, from my understanding, is she has excellent documentation. I have seen documentation of his obsessive stalking and harassing behavior. So she kept photographs and documents. I will say that one thing I have seen that's part of the police record by now, I'm sure, although we shouldn't assume anything, she kept very detailed notes of she broke off the relationship with Bill in March. I believe it was March 6th. And she's very clear. I don't want any more contact. And she logged every single time he tried to contact her. And he reached out through phone, through text, through Facebook, through Twitter, through WhatsApp. When he couldn't reach her, he sent presents. He sent a laptop to her apartment. Then he showed up at her apartment and slipped a piece of paper under her door and said he was thinking about committing suicide. And he was just relentless. And, you know, he would show up when she was like at a restaurant somewhere. She would look up and he would be walking across the street when he lives across town. And we're talking like hundreds of attempted contacts there after she says no.
And you said earlier on that this victim, this alleged victim, didn't like you at first and has since changed her feelings about you and now reached out to you.
Well, you know, I will say this. I don't know that even today. Well, two things I want to say. One, I'm not saying that she reached out to me. Two, I want to say that I don't know that I would say that she likes me right now.
Okay. Okay.
Wait,
I guess.
So what do you mean? You wouldn't say she reached out to you, but you were in contact with her.
I can't say to what extent, if I have been in contact with her. I can't get into the details of that because of these court cases.
Okay.
Okay.
Now, I guess the conversation sort of naturally leads to, is this related to Maura Murray?
I will say this. I'll say that the victim has alleged that she would like to talk to the detectives in the Maura Murray case. And I don't know if they have reached out to her yet. I don't know if she's connected with them. But there is this story that she has told that always creeped her out. And that was a story, you know, there's all these reports that Bill couldn't possibly have done it. And I'm not here to tell you, I think it was Bill. I don't know. I'm still holding out hope that Maura got away, because the more and more I learn, the more I realize that she had motive to get away and to want a safer place and a safer life. And dear God, I hope, I mean, wouldn't that be a great ending?
Sure would.
But for the people that say that there's, you know, no way, you know, all these people are, the family's, I think, official line is that Bill was with them as soon as he got into New Hampshire for the duration. And that's simply not true. He was mostly with his father, and you can look at his cell phone records and see they were all over the place. They were up into Vermont, all the way towards Maine. They were all over the place. So he told this, allegedly he told this woman a story about how he and his father came across this shed in the middle of nowhere, and he felt that Maura was inside. And they got to the shed and they did investigation, and they got, I don't know if they got into the shed or what, but you know, he says, well, she wasn't there. But this, for some reason, he told the story a couple times, and that story has stuck out to this woman. And there's something about that story that doesn't sit right with her. And she would like to discuss that with the detectives in New Hampshire.
I got to go back on that a little bit. This is a story that she was told by Bill. Where did this story come from?
From Bill to her.
Okay. Bill allegedly told her a story that he was searching for Maura with his own father, and came across this shed in the middle of the woods, and he just had this sixth sense that she was in there, that Maura was in there.
Correct.
That's a story that he allegedly told this woman.
Correct.
What do you think that was? Do you think, if this is true, do you think that was Bill's way of saying something about, like, maybe it was a confession almost, or do you think that he was just saying something to scare her, or do you think it actually happened?
What Bill likes to do, and what he's been trained to do, is mix falsehoods with truth in order to give it credibility and to make it sound like it has a ring of truth to it. And this was the feeling that she got when he told her this story.
Did she document that anywhere?
I'm sure she did.
Okay. And she wants to talk to the cold case unit about that. Did she, do you know if she emailed them or anything? Or I don't know. Wouldn't know. Wow. Well, that's all pretty interesting. So you're saying that was right after Mora went missing, that Bill was searching with his dad?
Yeah. We're talking like Wednesday or Thursday that week.
Why don't we ever hear more about Bill's dad?
Good question. I don't know.
Were they married still at the time?
I think so. They're still married now, right? I don't know.
I have no idea. That's really interesting that we could do so much work on this and not know if his parents are still together. And not know if this is the first that I've ever heard that his dad was there during the searches. Have you ever heard that, Tim?
I don't think so.
Have you heard that before this woman told you this, James?
Yeah, I had heard that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, maybe I forgot. I couldn't recall. I do remember hearing about his mom being there and taking notes and such.
Okay, so you said that according to some phone records, are these the phone records of Bill and his dad?
No, these are cell phone records? No, if you look at Bill's roaming, it's the phone records that are out in the public now. Okay. And if you look at Bill's phone records, look at the roaming. The roaming calls list the routed tower that was closest. So it'll have locations on the roaming charges. So it's like this roaming call came in through, you know, Manchester, New Hampshire. There was one that came in through Streaked Mountain, Maine. There was another that came in from Vermont. So you can kind of map. And at one point I did, you take all these roaming charges and kind of build a map based on the time frame. And again, that also, when you look at those phone records, you also, again, you come to the 5 days during that search where Bill, who is constantly using his phone before then, you know, making 60, 70 calls a day, goes completely radio silent. You know, there's a couple calls on that set. It just, you know, so I don't know. We're back to talking about the weirdness of the phone bills, but I don't know what to make of it. Again, I hold out hope that she's alive, and all we're dealing with here is somebody that wanted to get away would be the best case scenario.
Do you feel that you've been wrongly vilified for your work into this case?
I don't think I have. Well, first of all, I don't think I have been vilified. If I have, it's by, you know, again, we get back to this idea of the echo chamber. You know, it's a very small but very, very loud group of individuals that have a problem with the way I've reported things in this case. But, you know, I get wonderful emails and reviews on the book, you know, every week. So I try to concentrate on those. Of course, you know, it's the 1 in 10 that come in that really bum you out that you end up focusing on sometimes. You know, as far as unfairly, you know, to an extent, you know, and I think it goes back to, you know, if we want to open up this story, you know, the creation of the documentary and, working with the production team on that, and this takes you back to the fall of 2016, where, I was first approached about this documentary for the Oxygen Network and wanted to help them with research and everything. And we came to an arrangement and, you know, so they flew me, I think they flew you guys out too, but they flew me out to Austin in the fall of 2016. And, you know, I remember sitting down in their office and going over the whole case and providing them with all these documents. And they're just a really great group of people, you know, and that's the first time I met Art Roderick, and you know, he's certainly somebody to look up to, just a neat guy, and David and that whole crew. But you know, one thing that came out in that meeting was they're like, "Look, we're going to be honest with you. We really want to get the family on board and Fred Murray, but we think the only way we can get Fred Murray is if you." Is if we allow him to attack you, And if we allow him to say some mean things about you, and if we take apart your, you know, some of these theories that you've come up with online. And you know, my answer was pretty quick. I said, you know, do whatever you can. I think it's very important that you get Fred Murray on record. I think that would, you know, just for history, to have that and to have his version of events in essentially stone, you know, in his words. Let's get that. Let's have that. That's important. So, you know, I told him, I'm like, whatever you need to do, do it.
So you were essentially enlisted to be the bad guy of the series.
Yeah. And so, you know, I hear about this, and mind you, it's 9 months before that documentary series is going to run.
Right.
And so I'm sitting and thinking and digesting that for 9 months, knowing that this is going to be a national platform. And, you know, I have no idea how they're going to make me look in general, but I know for sure that Fred's going to say some mean things. And that's a hard thing to have to sit and stew over for 9 months. And that was probably the most difficult time. And it's actually, you know, I've been talking more and more about, and I talk about this in the tour that I do in the road show, where, you know, I do talk about mental health and the issues. And,
yeah,
you know, everybody I know that's doing something creative, and regardless of creative, everybody I know that's my age is going through a bit of an existential crisis. You know, some of my friends are getting divorced. You know, some of them are going through health concerns, and some of them are having mental health issues. And, you know, I've always had, I always knew I was like skating the fine line of substance abuse and alcoholism. And that was always a concern because, you know, that runs in my family. So does depression. And, so it was at that when I flew down to Austin and I had this meeting with the production company, and it just kind of hit me all at once, like, damn, like I'm going to have to, like, this is going to be hard. I've got to wait 9 months to see how bad, you know, I'm portrayed. And for the record, I think they did an excellent job on the documentary. And I think they were very fair about me. And I think they gave people the option to draw their own conclusions about who you ultimately want to believe and what everybody's agenda is. Yeah. So, you know, good.
Yeah,
for
you
them.
Definitely didn't come off looking like this overt, no. Like sinister villain.
Right, right. So it was so much worse in my imagination. But
of course.
So I go back to the hotel after this meeting, and I have, it took me a while to realize I was having a nervous breakdown. And the first real sign was I don't know if they put you up in the same hotel, but it's this like 6-story beautiful hotel with this atrium in the middle.
Yeah.
And there's like a swan swimming in like a river on the bottom level. But they put my room all the way up at the top. It's the 6th floor. And I get out of the elevator, and on the left...
Please tell me you did not jump into the swan pool.
But my concern was that I might. So I get off on the 6th floor, and there's a railing on my left. And I just got, you know, there's a French term for it, and I can't remember what it is. But it's the pull of the void. In English, it's called the pull of the void. It's that feeling you get that some people get when you go on you're standing on a cliff and it's like, well, what if, you know, what if I jumped? And that voice was so loud at that moment that I had to physically, put my back up against the wall across from the railing so that I could touch the wall all the way back to my room so that I wouldn't be close enough that I could jump, you know. So I get back to my room. And then later we all meet up for dinner and Art's there and, you know, we're all having sushi and we got, everybody was drinking and I knew I shouldn't be drinking. You know, I drank way too, I tried to keep up with Art, you know, and that's
good luck.
Yeah, it's like, you know, eventually that becomes like that scene in Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know, and where you're trying to match each other and you just can't keep up with art. So so I get back to the hotel and drinking always makes me, you know, it's a depressant, right? You know, you feel that euphoria, which is awesome, but then it wipes you out, man. And so I'm already feeling crummy. I get in the elevator to get up to my hotel room knowing that I'm going to have to like watch out for the railing again. And then Art steps into the elevator and we start going up and I'm like, oh, you're staying in this hotel too? And he's like, yeah. I'm like, oh, okay. And so we get off at the sixth floor and we're walking to my room and Art keeps following me. And I'm like, where the hell's your room? And I realize, like, as I get there, that they've put Art right next to my room. And then, of course, like, you know, I'm already, like, having essentially a breakdown. And so I become convinced that they've got my room wired so that they can listen in on, like, any sort of messages that I'm, you know, the conversations I'm having with my wife about, you know, about the production or about the, you know, the show or, you know, who knows what. And, you know, because I'm paranoid beyond, you know, delusion at this point. And so I completely take apart that room looking for cameras, looking for, microphones. And, it was a rough night. And, you know, I realized that I needed to do something about my, anxiety so that I could get through these next 9 months.
So your entire room, you took apart, and I can't help it. I'm not trying to make a joke, but I I can't help but think of the final like sequence in that movie, great movie called The Conversation with Gene Hackman, where right. He completely dismantles his apartment. He's pulling up the floorboards and he's pulling out the wall, and then the end, he's just kind of sitting there and he doesn't find anything. But you had this building anxiety and paranoia, and it was capped off by you realizing that Art was on the same floor as you, close to your room. And what was that like? So you get into your room and you just couldn't stop yourself. How were you able to stop? What was it like when you finally like took a step back and you thought to yourself that this was probably quite irrational?
I mean, it was, you know, the funny thing is if you go to the documentary, they almost did this exact same thing, right? Where you remember the interview with Kathleen Murray. You know, so as I'm watching that documentary, by the way, 9 months later, and I'm seeing that episode with Kathleen where they're doing exactly what I, you know, had in my mind. And I'm like, fuck, you know, maybe I didn't look hard enough. But I didn't like tear up the floorboards or anything, but I was on my back underneath the table and the desk, you know, checking for. Like I would even know what a bug would look like, by the way.
Right.
Oh, I think you'd know. I think you'd have a pretty good idea that it shouldn't be there.
Probably. But eventually Julie called to check in. And
your wife.
Yeah. And I explained to her what I was doing. And she's like, well, you're crazy. And I'm going to talk you down. And so that was helpful.
Okay. Well, good. I'm glad you've come out of that.
Yeah.
And things have been better since.
Yeah. I'm in a good place now, and the family's good, and all is well.
Does your anxiety go up when you like do you revisit these feelings when you post about like Bill and stuff like that?
Not anymore. I used to. You know, I think it took, you know, maybe the tours helped a little bit, but it took a while for me to get an objective, true look at this case. And it's not as big as, you know, as it feels when you're in it. You know, so there, you know, a couple things. One, you know, I am slowly pulling away from this case. You know, I'm not spending most of my time anymore trying to find out what happened to Maura Murray. I've got a pretty good idea, you know, it's one of two things, but I do feel the obligation and the responsibility to report on major things that happen as they occur, so that people can read what is hopefully a fair assessment of that, because I don't think that that they can get that fair assessment online in other blogs or other locations. So, and especially with the Bill Rausch thing, you know, I know these women now, and they trust me to tell their story and to tell it right. So I do feel a responsibility to continue covering that. But I have no desire to update the blog every day like I used to back in 2012, 2013.
Now, I'm curious what the purpose is of posting these findings that you have online on your blog. There's a sense of sensationalism to it, but what is your objective when you post something like what you've been posting about Bill and these allegations?
I don't know. I mean, where's the sensationalizing? Where does that, who's saying that they're sensational?
Oh, I'm saying that by seeing it online, one could look at it and say that this is, in a form, sensationalizing you as, you know, you're sensationalizing yourself as a journalist.
I don't know. I don't know if I agree with that, but I guess the basic question there is why would I post it on my blog, say, and not a newspaper site?
Or why post it anywhere?
For this, I think it's very... I think it is important in Maura's case, because at the very least, we're understanding the type of person that was in a relationship with Maura at the time of her disappearance. And what we're looking for is motive for her to get away, or to run away, or to just want to be away. And I think understanding who Bill Rausch is certainly provides the motive for her to want to get away for, at the very least, a small amount of time, but if not for good. I think what we know about him now suggests that she could have been successful in finding a battered woman shelter or a nonprofit for domestic violence that could set her up with a new identity.
But do you think that, you know, or have you explored the idea that Bill's behavior has come as a result of Maura's disappearance and not, what was it happening before her disappearance?
It absolutely was happening before her disappearance. There's these allegations go all the way back to high school, where he had a reputation of being rough with women.
Where is that? I don't think I've seen that.
I've reported on that in the past. It's probably still on my blog, but I spoke with an ex-girlfriend of his back in Ohio. So the allegations go back before Maura, and also, you know, there were members of Maura's track team, NAST, Shams for one, who were trying to get her to break up with Bill because of his controlling behavior.
There's never been anything documented where Maura said that he was abusive in any way, right?
Not that I've heard.
Do you mind if I just get back to the topic that we were just talking about? So are you saying that the purpose of putting this information out there is to satisfy the people who have been looking into this case, and we're essentially doing it as well. So I'm not trying to like cast stones or anything. I'm just really trying to wrap my own head around this. The purpose of putting this information out there is to satisfy the people who have been looking at this case, so they can finally have answers. They can finally have some sort of information that will lead to answers.
No, my main motivation for putting it out there is because every time I do, another woman comes forward.
Ah,
so by sharing this information, I'm hoping that anybody else that has had a run-in with this guy, and perhaps that run-in would provide more information on other cases, would see this. And, you know, I think there's strength in numbers, right? Where the more come out, the more likely that, you know, somebody out there who's afraid to do so will find the strength to do so.
Right. And part of my reason for asking that question is that you put yourself in the crosshairs quite often when you put this information out there. So I'm wondering if you see yourself as a virtual form of collateral damage.
I don't think that's not how I look at it. I think it's a responsibility. I'd rather not be the one that's putting it out there. But nobody else is reporting on it at this point. Although the DC City paper is, you know, covering some of the developments with the legal cases. I'd prefer to be writing novels and hanging out and having fun.
Speaking of novels, I am still waiting on my signed copy of Muse.
You didn't get it?
No, I did not. It must have gotten lost in the move.
That's bullshit, man.
Yeah. but also back to what Tim was bringing up, which made me think of this. It's almost within the same topic. Is there's nothing. There's allegations from other people that you said are dating back previous to Mora, but Mora never specifically told anybody that that this had happened. Are you anticipating someone might come forward eventually who said, "Yeah, I went to school with Mora, and she did say these things"?
I believe so. I believe, and it would be great, you know, if that person would come forward. I looking at this pattern of behavior, I would say I would be very surprised if it didn't, if it hadn't happened with Mora.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so should we point people to your email address if there is anyone out there who fits this category that would like to come forward?
I think you just go to the blog, you know, which I think is still moramurray.blogspot.com. You know, you can read about the reports there. There's also, you know, I also provide a way to send in tips and to contact me that will not give up your identity. So there's a program that you can use to send in tips that way too.
All right. Great. Is there any information on that weird little shed that she had said Bill told her that he thought Mora was in?
I don't know. I don't think she had much more. But yeah, I'm very much looking forward to the day that this case is done. And I'd like it sooner than later, whatever the answer is, so that we can do other things.
Speaking of other things, you mentioned your nonprofit. What is this nonprofit you speak of?
So it's called the Porchlight Project, and we focus on cold cases in Northern Ohio. And we're hoping to pick a new case every 3 months or so. And we provide anything from investigative services to you know, whatever they need to solve some of these cases that are 10 years old or older. In the case of Barbara Blatnick, which is our first case, we are providing money, the funds for new DNA testing and also forensic genealogy. Barbara was a young woman who was murdered in 1987. She was from Garfield Heights, but her body was found near Blossom Music Center out here in Cuyahoga Falls. And her murder's never been solved, but they had good DNA from under her fingernails. And so we've provided the funding we raised about $5,000, and that's going to pay for tests in an independent lab, which have just been done. And the data then goes to these forensic genealogists who, and the ones that we're using are Identifinders, which is run by Colleen Fitzpatrick in Southern California. And she's the woman who legitimately wrote the book Forensic Genealogy. So she knows what she's doing. And hopefully we're going to be, we'll have enough data to find a match to the killer through his family tree. You know, maybe we'll find a second cousin, and then the genealogist will trace the family tree back to this man who was at the scene of the crime. I'm very optimistic. I think this case is going to be solved in the next few weeks because of this. And
the next few weeks. Very good.
Yeah. Hopefully we'll get an answer on the Barbie Blatnick case and then be able to do more and more and more of these cases.
That's great. Any other books that you have coming up? What's in the works on that end?
I got another book coming out probably late 2020, but it's a little early to talk about that. Okay. I'm starting to work on a new season of The Philosophy of Crime, my podcast.
Fantastic.
So if your listeners haven't caught that yet, you know, The Philosophy of Crime is available on any, you know, podcast platform. And there are two seasons out, 12 episodes, 6 episodes every season. And it looks at the big questions behind true crime, like why are we obsessed with true crime? Do lie detectors really work? How does criminal profiling work? What are the ethics of familial DNA? Stuff like that. And then it goes to classical philosophy for answers. So, you know, what would Socrates say about this? What would Michel Foucault have to say about familial DNA? It's a neat little mix of philosophy and true crime.
Awesome. Do you ever get that feeling of I think it's actually pronounced l'appel du vide, the call to the void? Do you get that feeling still? Has that come back?
Oh, very good. Did you have to look that up or did you know that?
James, of course I had to look that up. You think I knew this off the top of my head? For the last 20 minutes, I've been trying to figure out how to say it.
You do have a little of that je ne sais quoi. Do I still get it? Of course, yeah, but I think everybody gets it, right? But it's not something that I'd worry about anymore following through with. I've definitely come out the other side, and you know, I'm kind of grateful that I went through that experience because it gave me a better, more realistic look at life and reality, and also what's important. And you know, I've been doing a lot of traveling lately, but there's nothing that makes me happier than being home with my kids. You know, and you know, Casey's 12 now, and Lane's 7. So I realized the other day that I'm exactly halfway through having kids in my house. You know, in another 12, Casey's 12. And in another 12 years, Lainey will be going to college. So that kind of hit me. It's like, wow, I'm halfway through. So, you know, I better enjoy this.
Yeah. Yeah. And do you think that the, this feeling, this call to the void was, something that the psychic that you went to, and you told us about in the Finding More Murray documentary, is that what she was indicating when she, was sending you, pretty overt warnings?
You know, I never thought about that. I never made that connection, but I like it.
Well, Tim, where's the breaking news sound effect?
Have you gone back to Gene the psychic?
I almost did. We were in Ocean City again this year, I thought about taking Casey there, and then we ended up getting busy eating like an elephant ear or something. But I was like 5 feet away from her like front door. And I thought about it, but part of me didn't want to ruin the magic of what happened that first time.
Must've been a great elephant ear.
They put like fudge on top of it and
I'm still very unclear as to what an elephant ear is. I even Googled and Binged it. And is it just like a crusty piece of dough?
Yeah. Yeah. That's all it is.
Oh, okay.
But it's delicious.
But it looks delicious. I was just unsure if there was something inside of it that I was missing.
No. just crusty dough. Well, thank you for having me back on your pageant. I always have a I always have a great time when I'm on, and then you know there's the buyer's remorse that comes later.
Right.
You know, I guess you know I just want to say, you know, we got to let these women you know tell their story and see where it goes, and you know, maybe it'll get us closer to some sort of answer. I don't know.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed. And I'm really encouraged by your answer about putting the information out there to hopefully have other people come forward. I think that's about as responsible as you can get with the information that you're given.
Thanks. Yeah.
Aside from going to law enforcement, which you have.
Thank you. And I'm always very much aware when I post these stories, you know, that word sensational is in the back of my mind. And I try to write these as, you know, with as much dignity, you know, as you can, you know, but people, you know, ultimately make their own opinion up, you know, for that. And every once in a while, you know, of course, I'll get excited about a piece of news and I'll say something stupid on Twitter because I'm genuinely like, this is news. This is, people are going to need to see this. This is exciting. This doesn't come in every day. I'm going to get a little excited about it every once in a while.